This podcast is sponsored by Debt Cleanse. Don't file bankruptcy. Try Debt Cleanse first.
Financial strategies you won't hear anywhere else for your house, your mortgage, and your future. Always accurate and occasionally entertaining, here's your host, Martin Andelman from MandelmanMatters.com.
Hello, this is Martin Andelman, and this is a Mandelman Matters podcast. Today, we're here to talk about a subject that I'm a little embarrassed about. I know very little, if anything, about Syria, the country, Syria, right? We've had a bunch of things going on, and it occurred to me that all I really know about Syria is that I like the food. That's about it. So coincidentally, and it's fortuitous, David Andelman, who, yes, is a cousin of mine, is an expert on Syria. He's recently published the book, A Red Line in the Sand, and it is all about red lines that exist all over the world. It's a fascinating book. David, are you with us?
I'm right here. And it's a podcast also, as a matter of fact, not in competition with yours, isn't it? There's no competition for yours, Martin.
Right. No, I was going to mention this. A Red Line in the Sand is a 12-part podcast series. I can't say enough about it. I've listened to it several times in each episode. That's how good it is. It tells you. And David, nowadays, I don't even know what to say about this. I know you've been in the media for an entire career, but it used to be that I'd watch local news and I'd get local stories. But when I turned on the news at 6 p.m., I got some international news. I also got U.S. news, but I got international news. Now, to watch the news, you would think there's only three or four things happening in this country, and they're all happening here. Because if there's no news anywhere else.
That's not really a new phenomenon, I hate to say this. I was 7 years at CBS in Paris, and we used to have the saying, if it bleeds, it leads. So if there was an explosion or terrorist attack or a war somewhere, you could be guaranteed that would be on the evening news that night. If there wasn't, it was hard to get on. Very often, if it was a wonderful feature, it got pushed over to the evening news on weekends or to the morning news or whatever. There were other outlets for it. But you're right. Look, there are 22 minutes on the nightly news after all the commercials and everything else. And then the intros to the stories and so on. So in fact, the room for pieces is down around 17, 18 minutes. And you got to do everything. And it's tough. It's one of the reasons why CBS, for one, and a lot of the other news organization, particularly CBS, have practically no foreign news bureaus anymore. And it's what I find particularly striking, just very quickly, and then we'll get to Syria, but if you watch the nightly news, I usually watch NBC now because I like Lester Holt, and I think they have really the best general group of correspondents around the world and producers. They very often, almost all of their foreign stories are voiced out of London. So you'll have pictures from maybe Moscow or from Beirut or from Syria or wherever, but the reporter is from London, and it's very clear they're not on the scene. Now, when I was there, you had to get the person there. We chartered planes at tremendous cost to get the reporter and the producer and the camera crews on the scene. That doesn't happen anymore, and it's a matter of money. It's all money.
Yeah, the answer is money. What was your question? So Syria, okay, this is about maybe a month ago, Syria made the news, and I have it in front of me, so I just want to say, on May 4th, Israel fires missiles into northwest Syria. And then on May 13th, we had rockets fired from Lebanese territories, and we've had rockets going back and forth. And now we're hearing about this Israel with Hamas situation. I guess there's a ceasefire as of today. And it all starts to blend together. And I know that Assad has been the president of Syria for a number of years, 20 years or something. And I know that Obama had some interaction there that he said he was going to do or didn't do or something happened. And then Trump handled this differently. And I'm not sure whether what happened in Syria when Trump was president was a positive thing or a negative thing. I don't know how to think about this at all. And so I wanted to have you on. Can you start by just explaining where Syria came from, where this all came from? What's going on there?
Well, Syria itself was a sort of an artificial construct, as are basically all of the countries in that part of the world. They were part of the Ottoman Empire originally after the First World War, which was the subject of my last book before this one, A Shattered Peace, Versailles 1919 and The Price We Pay Today. The peacemakers at Versailles carved up the Ottoman Empire, and a number of countries were created out. So you had Lebanon, you had Syria, you had Iraq, you had Turkey. So all of these countries were carved out of it. And, of course, Palestine, which became Israel, and then the Palestinian territories. They were all part of the Ottoman Empire, and they were all carved up in a fashion that really bore very little resemblance to what the realities were on the ground. But they were created. They created these countries. Actually, Syria, they were all, in fact, most of them were either under French or British rule for quite a number of years until they became independent. Lebanon was more French. Syria was more British, and Iraq were more British, as was Palestine. But eventually they became independent. And very quickly after that, in Syria, you had a dictator named Hafez al-Assad, Bashar's father, who became effectively the dictator. Now, they all characterized themselves as presidents. Hafez al-Assad and his son, they call themselves presidents. There were ostensibly democratic elections, but they were a joke. So the Assad family has ruled Syria for close to a half a century now, and it hasn't been a wonderful rule. They've been basically concerned about enriching and entrenching their own family and friends and so on in power and wealth, and everybody else had to fend for themselves. So at any rate, and they participated in various times in wars against Israel. They were one of the countries that in 1948 invaded Israel. The Arab countries all began the first war with Israel as soon as its independence was proclaimed. And they've done it again in several other times. Eventually, the Israelis seized the Golan Heights, which was a portion of Syria that overlooks Israel and where they were afraid that Israel could come under attack. And there have been various exchanges of weaponry, gunfire and rockets and so on over the years, but not much since then. Now, in the last several years, of course, particularly since the Arab Spring, Bashar al-Assad himself has come under attack in his own country. There's a civil war has broken out. And that's where the whole country began falling apart, and it basically disintegrated. So you say you love Syrian food. Unfortunately, you find the best Syrian food outside of Syria now because people are not very well fed. When you talk about Obama and Trump and Syria, you come really down to a very critical red line, which Obama proclaimed about 8 or 9 years ago. And he basically said, it was an offhand remark at a press conference. And an NBC correspondent asked Obama, who happened to stop in the press room just by chance to talk up his economics bill, finance bill that he had in Congress. And he was asked at that moment, what happens if Assad uses chemical weapons against his own people, which had been rumored for a while. And Obama just off the top of his head said, now that's a red line, something we cannot tolerate. If that happens, there will be consequences. But that is a firm, clear red line in the sand, of course, but that's my book, which was not yet reality at that point. A year later, of course, Assad did use sarin gas against his own people. And the pictures began getting out. There were horrific shots and so on. Britain, France, and the United States all basically said, we have to retaliate. And there was a lot of back and forth. This went on for some weeks. Eventually, the British Parliament voted against participating in a retaliation. The French were all set. They were going gung-ho. They had plans set. They had their Mirage jets on the runways, fueled and ready to go, and armed with cruise missiles. And they had a carrier base in the French carrier base in the Mediterranean, ready to go. And the United States was prepared as well. But at the last minute, Obama had second thoughts, and he backed down. Eventually, he sided with a concept that Putin came up with, which was basically to save, and to pardon the expression, Assad's ass, and basically said that we'll take charge of getting all the chemical weapons out of Syria, and it will be fine, and no one needs to retaliate. The result was the United States didn't retaliate. The French were left holding the bag as the last country that was prepared to do that, and they didn't. The reputation of François Hollande, the French president, cratered, and within 2 years after that, when he was ready to stand for re-election, his popularity rating was around 8%, and he just chose not to run for re-election again. So it basically destroyed Hollande's political career. It certainly did not do very much for Obama's reputation in terms of the ability to, or the willingness to stand up behind and back red lines that they had set. So that was gone. Along comes Trump. And several months into Trump's presidency, Assad does the same thing again. He uses chemical weapons on his own people. I frankly suspect it was a little bit of a test to see how Trump might respond. This time, Trump did fire 59 Tomahawk missiles at the cruise missiles at the Syrian air base that the environs where these supposedly these chemical weapons were launched from. It basically did nothing. It was a medium-sized strike that had very little long-term impact. And the next day, the Syrian Air Force was flying out of that same air base. So it was a joke. But by then, of course, Putin had cemented his relations with Assad. The Russians were firmly in Syria and implanted there. More and more of their troops were coming in. They had a naval base on the Mediterranean, which was one of Putin's great goals. And increasingly, Russian air power began coming in to fly out of Syrian air bases. So that's where we stood. And Assad was able to continue his campaign against military campaign against those who had fought against the civil war, the insurrectionists who had fought and tried to unseat him.
This podcast is sponsored by Debt Cleanse. If debt has become a problem, you need to check out Debt Cleanse. Don't file bankruptcy. Try Debt Cleanse first. It's only $29 a month. You get the first month free, and you can cancel anytime. What do you have to lose? Debt Cleanse can help you get out of debt. Creditors make mistakes all the time. Debt Cleanse helps you catch them. Debt Cleanse can do more for your financial situation than anything else. You've got to give it a try. You reach Debt Cleanse simply at 1-800-500-0908. That's 1-800-500-0908. And tell them you heard about them on Mandelman Matters. So would you say, was this a failure of both the Obama administration and the Trump administration? Have we just failed?
It's a failure by everyone. The Brits did the same thing. The Brits, they refused to go in also to uphold the red line. Now, mind you, they were not responsible for creating the red line in the first place. The United States was. But nevertheless, they refused to go along with it. I listened to a lot of the debate. It was like a nine-hour debate in the Commons. It was quite fascinating. And it's all on tape. You can listen to the whole thing. And it's quite extraordinary because the people were basically saying after Iraq and the weapons of mass destruction, which didn't exist in Iraq, and they were suckered into coming in and helping American forces in Iraq and then in Afghanistan and so on. We don't trust the American intelligence that this was actually, sarin gas, which everybody could see the pictures. It was pretty clear. We were abandoned by our allies in that respect. And so, yeah, to a certain extent, both Trump and Obama had the same problem there. It was a problem of credibility among our allies.
Now we have President Biden, and we have a lot going on. What is this? Do you think this administration is going to have a different policy on Syria, or are we just going to keep the dance
on Syria? I don't see that's very high on their list right now, unless something bizarre happens. We have basically pulled out of Syria. We've abandoned Syria. We basically said under Trump, and to reverse a policy like that is going to be very difficult. It's really going to take some extraordinarily idiotic move on the part of Assad for us to, I think, reverse that and really go back into Syria in any substantial way. We can basically write off Syria as a focus of American military or foreign policy at this point. Look, if suddenly Syria decides they're going to attack Israel, side with Hamas or Hezbollah, which is now basically rules Lebanon, aside from some bizarre action like that, and I can't believe that Assad would be A, so stupid, and B, have the means to divert himself from his own internal problems to take on something like that. I think basically the people of Syria they're stuck with him until something traumatic happens, like he dies or his generals lose faith in him or what have you, which I don't see happening.
But as recently as May 14th, the report said that three rockets were fired from Syria towards Israel. They didn't hit anything, but were fired.
Right. Again, we don't know who fired them. Hezbollah has been active in those places, and they're no friends of Israel. So it's hard to say who the authors of those attacks were. Two or three rockets are something that, are virtually meaningless strategically. When you look at the thousands of, or hundreds of, certainly hundreds, maybe thousands of rockets that the Hamas has fired and that the Iron Dome defense system of Israel was easily able to handle. I can't imagine that that's really going to really move anybody to take any kind of action against Syria at this point.
Yeah, what's three or four missiles between
four enemies? Right.
So Have you been to Syria?
I've actually been to Syria, no. Sorry. But I've been in every country around there, so I certainly know. And I've studied the area very carefully.
And you've had meetings with some of the government officials throughout the Middle East. Can you speak to some of those?
I've met all kinds of people. I've had a long interview with my first encounter with an Israeli official was Menachem Begin back in the 1980s. That was interesting. I've talked to Muammar Gaddafi twice. I interviewed him twice. Yasser Arafat, I got to know quite well, and particularly when he was in Tunis, in sort of exile, if you will. I met Sadat from Egypt. Actually, I first met him in Romania when he was paying a visit to Ceausescu back in the 1970s. Yeah, I've met a lot of interesting, a lot of interesting people in that part of the world.
Yeah. Yeah, so you really have a feel for this. Is the civil war, is there still a civil war in Syria? Is this is just going to continue and they'll keep using gas if they want to and no one will really do anything?
Not much of a civil war anymore. Assad has pretty much taken over managed to take over most of the country and get rid of most of his opposition. There's a small corner, some small pockets in northern Syria that the rebels are still holding or still ensconced in, and he's working on those very assiduously. I guess at some point it'll be over, whatever that means. I think there's always going to be so much opposition to him in the hearts of Syrians that it's bound to break out again in the future. I don't know. It's hard to see how there could be any real peace in Syria as long as Assad and his henchmen are in power. But he's been so effective, and his allies, the Russians, have been so helpful in so many respects in terms of tamping down and eventually eradicating his opposition, that I don't see really how it could jump up again, reemerge again. I think that one thing was interesting was the unity of other countries in terms of eradicating the Islamic State. I think that was very critical, because the focus was taken for so long off of the civil war and the campaign against Assad, and focused on the Islamic State, which was itself an enemy of or inimical to the Assad regime. And now that's gone. There's really no motivation for any foreign power to come in and really help the civil war, the rebels in Syria.
So it sounds overall like we're no closer to having any sort of peace in the Middle East than we were when I was a kid. Yeah. Is that
I mean, I think what's different is I don't think we're going to see any of the mass assaults on Israel by all of the Arab countries as we did during the Yom Kippur War, the Six-Day War, the war right after the liberation of freedom of Israel in 1948. I don't think we're going to see anything like that. That's just not going to happen. Remember, Egypt, which was one of the principal leaders of the Arab forces that attacked Israel during those other wars, the Yom Kippur War and the war of the 1948 war and the Six-Day War, they're the ones that are actually sending in peacemakers now, mediators to Hamas and to Gaza and Israel. So I just don't see a massive attack on Israel like that again for the foreseeable future, because they realize they can't win. And I think the governments now have enough focus on other internal problems, especially, that they're not going to take on Israel. They don't see that. And what's interesting is, by the way, parenthetically, is some of the other Arab countries that have backed attacks on Israel like that in the past, and now, thanks to as a result of Kushner's peace plan, they're now allies of, or they at least have diplomatic relations with Israel. So Bahrain, the Emirates, Qatar, and so forth, they actually have, there are air flights going between those countries now, which would never have been possible before, never even remotely. So the atmosphere has changed. The priorities have changed in the Middle East.
Was Kushner's work positive? Is that seen as positive?
Because, and one of the reasons I say that, and I wrote a column actually about this for CNN about a week ago, the problem was that it was predicated on an assumption that Israel, particularly Netanyahu, was never prepared to make good on, which is to say it would be a status quo for at least 4 years in the West Bank, particularly the West Bank, the settlements, where the Israelis would not expand the settlements into Palestinian territory any further than was set forth in a couple of very detailed maps in the peace plan, which I have a copy of, in fact, one of which I reproduced in my book. And yet nobody really believed that was going to happen. And within days or weeks of the signing of the peace accord, the Israelis had begun violating these terms and had begun gradually moving into the settlement, or creeping settlement expansion. So that is itself a violation. And some of these other countries like Bahrain, the Emirates, and so on, that agreed to normalize relations with Israel on the basis of some of these provisions of the Abraham Accord, they call it, Jared Kushner's peace plan. I can't believe that they're not going to be watching this and saying, do we really want to continue as a friend of Israel, considering that Israel clearly is still no friend of the Palestinians, because they have always believed the Palestinians deserve a homeland in their own, and that Israel needs to move in that direction. And Israel is not moving in that direction. And finally, of course, the Palestinian leadership has never accepted the validity of this peace plan. So I don't know how you can have a peace plan in Israel without including the Palestinians in some fashion. And they just, they would refuse to participate in it from day one.
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't know this. I just recently learned that the largest supporters of Israel are not Jews in America. They're not Jews around the world. It is evangelical Christians that are supporting Israel in the largest number.
The sacred sites to Christianity that are in Israel, and they want to make sure that they have access to that regularly. And I can understand that. Look, Jerusalem is a city of three religions. And for some reason, Israel hasn't recognized that fact fully. And that's where a lot of the problems stem from originally.
Yeah, and that movement doesn't want to see Israel give up any land. They want all of it. And so we won't have peace. This will just go on for another lifetime.
The last couple of ceasefires, last couple of exchanges between in previous years, there were anywhere between 6 and 10 different truces before a final truce actually held. So a lot of people are very skeptical about this truce that began at 7 o'clock last night. Eastern time.
So Obama was criticized as not being pro-Israel enough, and then Trump seems to have gotten credit for being pro-Israel enough, and now we have the Biden administration. Do you think going forward it's just going to be a non-issue in this presidency, or do you think this is going to be something that's going to
Biden's going to have to deal with it.
There's
a lot of sentiment in Congress, increasing sentiment in Congress now, that is not pro-Israel. And in fact, is skeptical of Netanyahu particularly, and Israel and its good faith. And I think that's something that Biden is going to have to deal with. I think that's one of the reasons why he was so tough on Netanyahu from the get-go. There were a lot of people in Congress, including, by the way, the first Palestinian member of Congress, from a Democratic representative from Michigan, who have actually buttonholed them. In fact, she buttoned Biden when he went on that trip to the Ford plant to drive the new all-electric F-150. She buttonholed him and spent 8 minutes on the tarmac at the airport telling him how badly he was handling this and he needed to be tougher on the Israelis. And I think there's a lot of increasing sentiment on the fact that the United States has to have a more even-handed position in that part of the world. I really believe that myself, frankly. I think we have to approach this as we would approach any other crisis that involved allies of us. We have to understand that if we want to play the good officer, we have to be able to, both sides have to accept that we'll be fairly even-handed in our treatment of them.
I hope that happens. I don't know. I think we've become a little bit politically dysfunctional.
It's really astonishing. There are something like 26 different political parties that are in the Knesset, in the parliament, in Israel. And there are at least another 20 or so outside that are trying to get in, that don't even have one representative there. And they have to try and put together a government. And so they've tried four times now. They're apparently going to have a fifth election in about 2 years, very shortly. And this is one thing that Netanyahu is particularly worried about. I think he thinks for some reason that attacking the Hamas and cracking down the Palestinians on the West Bank as well, that'll help him win the kind of majority he needs to put together a coalition from these incredibly disparate parties. I don't think that's necessary. If that's the case, then I think Israel really is more dysfunctional than any of us really gave it credit for. But that kind of a democracy in this day and age is just not going to work. For that matter, I don't think that's a digression. I don't know that a two-party system in this country is going to work anymore. I'm not sure we even have one, but a 52-party system is unwieldy on the other extreme.
Yeah, that sounds insane. Look, thank you so much for coming on and doing this and taking the time. I really appreciate it. I know you'll be back next week and we will be talking about the subject I can't wait to talk about, which is media bias. Does it exist? Where does it exist? How does it exist? What's true? What's not? And I know everybody's going to want to tune in to hear that.
Both the Overseas Press Club of America and the Silurian Press Club. I have a lot to say about that.
All right, perfect. I am looking forward to it. We will talk early next week.
Great pleasure.
Thank you so much for being on.
This episode is complete. Stay tuned for more updates on all the political, social, and economic and legal aspects of the financial crisis. Complicated subjects made easy to understand at mandelmanmatters.com.